Well, yesterday was a wonderful first day of our theology conference. I'm grateful to Timothy for laying some of the groundwork historically of, or biblically and theologically, of the nature of the church, and then some of the historical expressions of that. And I'm also grateful for Michael Lawrence for his lecture, focusing more on the expression of the gospel in the local church and the boundaries, and focusing on baptism and the Lord's Supper and membership. His lecture prompted a lot of discussion amongst Free Church folk. Obvious by the laughter or whatever. But I think it's important for us. We are Bible people, and so we ought not to be afraid of that. It's not that we're pushing an agenda. We historically we've been weak ecclesiologically. Now, that doesn't mean that let's end up in the Roman Catholic direction or in the Anglican direction or whatever the case might be. But it's presented to help us to think about things that we often haven't in a lower sort of church sort of manner in which has been more our history. And so the exhortation for us comes from our history, which is, where stands it written, brothers? And so let's use this as an opportunity. That's why we have done what we have done. It's to help us to think about things and then to talk about things in ways that bring us back to the Bible. And it doesn't mean that then in expression we end up where Michael has ended up or any others of us have ended up, but we talk about it seeking to be faithful to God's word, right? So the fact that it's prompted discussion, I'm thankful. I'm prayerful that it'll help us and move us in a direction that is healthy and godly back to the scriptures. And so there are breakouts this afternoon. Disappointingly, Michael will not be here to field those questions. Bill Kynes will be, one of our own Free Church people. So there's an opportunity to discuss that further. Let's continue the discussion. And not just on that issue, but all the other issues that are around the church affect the church as well. The other thing I would suggest is this. For those of us that are a little older, this is the message that a lot of younger people are hearing. And so they're coming into the Free Church with this sort of message that they've heard. So how then do they enfold into the Free Church with this sort of teaching that they've heard? And so it's important for us to recognize that. There, I think, at this conference, there are as many young people to the theology conference as we've had in the past. There's probably a reason for that. They're asking questions about the church. Questions that many of us that are a little older, we've solved. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. So I just remind you of the breakouts this afternoon. You see them in your notebook, and you will self-select. And so those issues that you want to learn more or hear more about, I encourage you to take a look at those and then plan to attend the correct one. And these are not another lecture, by the way. They're opportunities to dialogue. That's the intent of the breakout. I found it interesting that in light of yesterday's message from Michael Lawrence, that today, January 21st, 1525, Anabaptists came into being in Zurich when Conrad Grebel baptized George Blorock on this date, 1525. One final piece of information this morning, that is Michael Lawrence will send us his lecture manuscript, which we will post on our EFCA Theology Conference website, where we will also post all the other plenary lectures that are being recorded. So all of this material will be on our website. I summarize. We've looked at the biblical and theological nature of the church through history. From the foundation, we then looked at the church as a visible community, focusing on the boundary markers of the church. In our first lecture this morning, we look at another important image of the church, a new kinship community. The gospel creates a new family that has profound implications for how we view our life together as the people of God. This new faith family creates new relationships and new structures and transforms the old such that this family supersedes all other relationships. In this lecture, we will learn that these truths have profound implications for how we understand the church. It is a family, not a business. It is relational, not institutional. It grows spiritually, not biologically. Dear friends, I heard Joe Hellerman give this lecture last year at a plenary session of the Evangelical Theological Society meeting and concluded it would be invaluable for us to have him address this vital truth at our theology conference on the doctrine of the church. Thankfully, he agreed. Joe serves as professor of New Testament language and literature at Talbot School of Theology in La Mirada, California. He has taught a number of Free Church pastors that have attended Talbot. He's taught there more than a decade and ministered in the church simultaneously much of his adult life. His seminary training at Talbot focused on Old Testament studies, while his doctoral research at UCLA dealt with social history of the early Christians. He's authored a number of academic monographs, and he's written two books about Christian community for pastors and other church leaders. Some of you have read them, When the Church Was a Family and Embracing Shared Leadership. His most recent book is Philippians, Exegetical Guidebook to the Greek New Testament. In addition to serving full-time in the New Testament department at Talbot, Joe also serves as co-pastor at Oceanside Christian Fellowship in El Segundo, California. That's a free church. Joe's married and has two adult daughters. Joe, I'm grateful that you're here with us. Please come. We're eager to hear what you have to teach us about the church as a new kinship community, a family. Thank you,
Fred. Well, thank you so much. It's a delight to be here among brothers and sisters from the Free Church. Not such a delight to be where it's so cold. A couple of my co-presenters this morning in the lobby in the hotel were making fun of me because I don't own a winter coat. I live on the beach in California, and the house I grew up in, of all things, I've been in the same house for 63 years on and off, and that's quite a story of its own. As a point of departure, let me just say that what Greg said about new ideas challenging us to go back to the scriptures, our plumb line of truth and reality, is very, very pertinent. I'm a New Testament guy. I teach, people ask me what I do at Talbot, I tell them I'm paid to teach Greek, but I'm called to take the ecclesiology our students come in with and turn it on its head. And that's kind of my life calling. And one of the things that has really thrilled me over the kind of my academic pilgrimage is the rise of what we call multicultural hermeneutics. And simply, that's a fancy way of saying we have a lot of people of different backgrounds who are at the table of Bible interpretation now. So as you're surely aware, we're hearing interpretations of familiar passages that we've never heard before and all this kind of stuff. And some find that very threatening. I find it very encouraging because of the simple fact that for those of us who don't buy into the community construction of reality and think that the Bible really does speak the truth, these different interpretations drive us to go back behind our traditions to the first century, to the 7th century BC, in the case of certain Old Testament prophets, and really see what the Bible has to say about these issues. And that, not to denigrate tradition at all, but that's a very refreshing and important thing for us. And so some of what I present today is going to be a little bit scandalous, to say the least. And my challenge is, let's just go back to the scriptures and sort it out together. And see where the scriptures lead us on this. So with that, I'll begin. I've been asked to, as Greg mentioned, to talk about a small but a very important piece of the ecclesiological puzzle today, namely the idea of the church as a family. And I want to begin with a story. Sometime around 250 AD in the rural town of Thena, just outside the great Roman city of Carthage in North Africa, a pagan became a Christian. We don't know his name, so in what follows, I'm going to refer to him as Marcus. Marcus's conversion created quite a stir in the church at Athena because Marcus was an actor in the Greco-Roman theater, and the ancient theater was entangled in some highly questionable morality. Most problematic was the theater's close association with pagan religion. Performances were typically dedicated to pagan gods and goddesses, and they often ran as part of larger public religious festivals. Scenes portraying blatant immorality were commonplace. Church leaders were universally outspoken in their opposition to the ancient theater. Tertullian, an early second century leader from Carthage, apparently ran into Christians who found it acceptable to view morality on the stage, provided that they did not engage in that behavior in real life. He categorically rejects this kind of rationalization. Quote, "Why is it right to look on what it is disgraceful to do? If you are going to forbid immorality, you'd better forbid the theater. What you reject in deed, you are not to bid welcome in word." Well, if Christian leaders had this much of a problem with believers who attended the shows, you can imagine how they felt about the performers themselves. When an actor converted to Christ in 3rd century Carthage, the first thing the church demanded of him was to quit his profession and to disassociate himself from the theater forever. Our actor friend Marcus did just that. Marcus became a follower of Jesus. He bowed to the demands of the Christian community, and he stopped acting in the local theater. Our new convert now faced an economic dilemma, however, since he was no longer gainfully employed. So instead of acting, Marcus decided, hear this well, to teach acting. Marcus opened an acting school. Well, this apparently raised some eyebrows among Marcus's fellow Christians. Soon, both the pastor of the small church in Athena and the bishop of the big city congregation in Carthage found themselves embroiled in the ensuing damage control. The surviving letters exchanged by these two Christian leaders paint an inspiring portrait of the church living out its surrogate family values. Marcus's pastor, we do know his name, Eucratius, naturally sensed a certain contradiction in his new convert's behavior. After all, how could it be acceptable for Marcus to teach others to do what he himself was forbidden to do? Yet Marcus had already made a tremendous sacrifice to follow Jesus, a sacrifice that had cost Marcus his job. So Eucratius wrote to his spiritual mentor, Cyprian of Carthage, to ask, quote, whether such a man, namely Marcus, ought to remain in communion with us. For Cyprian, there simply was no place for moral compromise in the Christian life. Cyprian's convictions about Marcus working as a drama teacher could not be more straightforward. "It is not in keeping with the reverence due to the majesty of God and with the observance of the gospel teachings for the honor and respect of the church to be polluted by contamination at once so degraded and so scandalous." No compromise, no drama teaching. Marcus must either leave the church or quit his job again. But the best is yet to come. Cyprian is not unaware of the hardship that will come upon Marcus if he stops teaching his craft. As the ensuing comments in Cyprian's letter clearly demonstrate, the intense emphasis upon personal holiness, which characterized North African Christian community, had a beautiful complement, namely a genuine concern for those whose livelihoods might be adversely affected by assenting to the church's demanding moral standards. In short, Cyprian tells Pastor Eucratius that the church should provide for Marcus's basic needs. His needs can be alleviated, Cyprian writes, along with those of others who are supported by the provisions of the church. Accordingly, you should do your utmost to call him away from this depraved and shameful profession to the way of innocence and to the hope of true life. Let him be satisfied with the nourishment provided by the church, more sparing to be sure, but salutary. And if this isn't enough, Cyprian concludes his letter by telling Eucratius that Cyprian's church will foot the bill if the rural church in Athena lacks the resources to meet Marcus's basic needs. Quote again, "But if your church is unable to meet the cost of maintaining those in need, Marcus can transfer himself to us and receive here what is necessary for him in the way of food and clothing." Cyprian demanded of those in God's family an uncompromising standard of Christian morality. No theater, no acting, no teaching others to be actors. God's people would be radically different than the pagans in the dominant culture. But Cyprian made sure that the family of God would serve as the economic safety net for any brother or sister whose finances were adversely affected by their willingness to follow Jesus. We have no surviving letter from Eucratius back to Cyprian to let us know whether or not Marcus agreed to shut down his acting school and rely on his faith family to meet his material needs, but we're on pretty solid historical ground to assume that he did just that, because history has shown us that pagans in Carthage were consistently attracted to, rather than turned off by, the intensely moral, highly supported surrogate family model that characterized the North African church. 50 years before Marcus found the Lord, Tertullian could boast to the North African pagans, "Day by day you groan over the ever-increasing number of Christians. Your constant cry is that your state is beset by us, that Christians are in your estates, your camps, your blocks of houses, that persons of every age and every social rank are passing over from you to us." How could this happen? How could a small Jewish sect arising in a province located at the easternmost fringes of the Roman Empire have expanded its ranks steadily for more than two centuries in the face of often sporadic and local, sometimes consistently legislated opposition? One of Rome's emperors, who was not at all happy with the growth of early Christianity, thought he had the answer to the question of why Christianity was expanding. The fellow I'm about to quote is a real piece of work. His name says it all, Julian the Apostate. His uncle was Constantine, the first Roman emperor who professed allegiance to Christianity. Constantine had put an end to the Christian persecutions a couple generations before Julian walked onto the stage of imperial political history. Much of the empire was at least nominally Christian in Julian's day, and Julian was provided with the best in theological education. Julian turned his back on the Lord, however, and converted to paganism. And then through a series of political intrigues and military victories, he became emperor in 361 AD. Julian then embarked on a mission to turn the Roman Empire back to the gods and goddesses of paganism. Among Julian's surviving works is a fascinating letter to a pagan priest friend in Galatia. Julian recognizes that in his efforts to resuscitate paganism, he must first figure out why Christianity, which he calls atheism because the Christians didn't worship the gods, had become so successful. Here's what he wrote. He says, "Why do we not observe that it is the Christians' benevolence to strangers, their care for the graves of the dead, and the pretended holiness of their lives that have done the most to increase atheism? When the impious Galileans support not only their own poor, but ours as well, all men see that our people lack aid from us." Julian is convinced that Christians attracted people through tangible expressions of love directed toward each other and toward those outside the church. Another pagan detractor, Lucian of Samosata, traced behavior like this back to the family metaphor in the teaching of Jesus. Lucian disparagingly wrote, "Their first lawgiver," he won't even say the name Jesus, "persuaded them that they are all brothers of one another. Therefore, they despise all things indiscriminately and consider them common property." As Tertullian would remark a few decades later, "We call ourselves brothers. So we who are united in mind and soul have no hesitation about sharing what we have. Everything is in common among us." Oh, except our wives. Let's get that one in there. You know, we chuckle, but I tell our folks at church and my students that, you know, the two things that really marked Christianity out, early Christianity out as unique in the Roman Empire, was the social dynamic that we're talking about today and the sexual ethic of monogamous, heterosexual, committed marriage relationships. Those two things were really key markers of Christian identity in the pagan world. But we're focusing today on this idea we call ourselves brothers, as Tertullian puts it, and we need to understand what that's all about, because family was the central social model for relationships in the early church, and we encounter surrogate kinship language throughout Christian literature. But kinship in Mediterranean antiquity was understood differently than we conceive of family today. And we need to grasp these differences in order to properly appreciate what the New Testament writers had in mind when they pictured the church as a family. Perhaps the most counterintuitive aspect of Mediterranean kinship concerns the family relationship that ancient people valued the most. In our world, a person's spouse ideally functions as A, his or her central locus of relational loyalty, and B, main source of emotional and material support. Correspondingly, most Americans expect their closest relational bond to be the bond of marriage, and we build our families around that relationship. In antiquity, however, family was built not around marriage, but was instead based on blood. In antiquity, a person viewed as family those with whom he shared a common patriline, a bloodline traced from generation to generation solely through the male line. On the diagram, the bloodline, family membership is highlighted in yellow. Notice that in the patrilineal family, only a father can pass family membership down to the next generation. A mother cannot. A male, therefore, regarded as immediate family, A, his father from whom he had received his blood, B, his brothers and sisters with whom he shared his blood, and C, offspring of both genders to whom a male passed on his blood, that is, family membership. Females, like males, viewed fathers and siblings as blood kin. Notice, though, that since, however, a mother could not pass on membership in her patriline to the next generation, her children technically belonged not to her family, but rather to the patriline of her husband. And because a husband and wife had different fathers, and therefore belonged to different patrilines, married persons in the world of the New Testament generally expressed primary relational allegiance not to a spouse, but rather to members of their family of origin. The blood-based orientation of ancient family systems profoundly informs the degree of loyalty and solidarity which characterized various family relationships. For persons in the Mediterranean world, and here's the real payoff here, among same-generation relationships, the closest family tie of loyalty and affection was not the contractual relationship between a husband and wife. It was the blood relationship between siblings, brothers and sisters. The emotional bonding modern Westerners expect as a mark of a healthy husband and wife relationship was normally characteristic in the ancient world of sibling relationships. Text after text from the ancient world underscores the centrality of the sibling bond. In the words of the Jewish author of the book of Sirach, "My soul takes pleasure in three things, and they are beautiful in the sight of the Lord and of men: agreement between brothers, friendship between neighbors, and a wife and husband who live in harmony." Note the priorities. First on Sirach's list comes agreement between siblings. Among our most important non-canonical texts from the period is a collection of works known as the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs. Joseph presents himself in his testament as the ideal strong group sibling. He recounts the various times he refrained from retaliation and protected his brother's honor even in the face of their treachery. Then he concludes, quote, "So you see, my children, how many things I endured in order not to bring my brothers into disgrace. You therefore love one another and in patient endurance conceal one another's shortcomings. God is delighted by harmony among brothers." Highlight that last statement. It epitomizes ancient Mediterranean family values. A passage from the Book of Jubilees illustrates how another Second Temple Jew felt about the solidarity and the inviolability of the sibling bond. The anonymous author of this second century BC retelling of the Book of Genesis fills in what he perceives to be a lacuna in the biblical narrative when he portrays the patriarch Isaac offering a final charge to the now reconciled Jacob and Esau. He writes, "Among yourselves, my sons, be loving of your brothers as a man loves himself, with each man seeking for his brother what is good for him. And each one will love his brother with compassion and righteousness, and no one will desire evil for his brother from now and forever, all the days of your lives." Sentiments like these provide the background for interpreting the meaning of brother in the New Testament. Substitute brothers in Christ, or brother, for brothers in the above excerpts, and you'll begin to get an idea of the kind of relational solidarity that Jesus and Paul envisioned for the early church. Now, if the most important relationship in the ancient world was the bond between blood brothers, then it only follows conversely that the betrayal of a sibling constituted the worst family tragedy imaginable. And it's interesting that Isaac's challenge to Jacob here in Jubilees concludes with some rather severe consequences for someone who betrays a brother. Quote, Isaac says, "And if either of you seeks evil against his brother, know that hereafter each one who seeks evil against his brother will fall into God's hands and be uprooted from the land of the living, and his seed will be destroyed from under heaven. And on the day of turmoil and execration and indignation and wrath, then with devouring burning fire, just as he burned Sodom, so too he will burn up his land and his city and everything which will be his. And he will not be written on high in the book of life. I am exhorting you, my sons, according to the judgment which will come upon the man who desires to harm his brother." Throughout ancient literature, not just in Jewish sources, strife between siblings is viewed as the epitome of the breakdown of the social order. The Roman poet Ovid, for example, contrasts the current golden age of Rome under Augustus, under which he's living, with the horrors of the earlier Iron Age of the Roman civil wars. He looks back and reflects. He says, "All manner of crime broke out. Modesty, truth, and loyalty fled. Treachery and trickery took their place. Deceit and violence and criminal greed." And then this crescendo. "Friend was not safe from friend, nor father-in-law from son-in-law, and even between brothers, affection was rare." Of interest here is the fact that the first sin recorded after the fall of Adam and Eve, the biblical archetype for all interpersonal sin, is the murder of Abel at the hands of Cain. To Cain's query, "Am I my brother's keeper?" the only conceivable answer in a patrilineal descent group society would be a resounding yes. Indeed, the Hebrew scriptures are filled with battles between brothers and sisters. Jacob steals Esau's birthright and blessing. Joseph is betrayed by his brothers. Aaron, Miriam, and Moses bicker with one another. David and his brothers face off. Chaos erupts among David's children, Amnon, Tamar, Absalom, and later between Solomon and Adonijah. The sense of tension and drama surrounding the engrossing theme of sibling rivalry and sibling betrayal helps explain why these narratives were so engaging to the ancient Jews who heard them read in their synagogues during the New Testament period. So grasping the centrality of the sibling bond in the Mediterranean family has the potential to revolutionize the way in which we read the brother and sister terminology that occurs so often in the New Testament, which I often think we just take as a cipher for believer and just move on and don't catch the social significance of those terms. It also has the potential, by extension, to revolutionize the quality of our relationships in the family of God today. But what did it mean to live in community as brothers and sisters in the early church? Well, sibling solidarity, as the New Testament Christians envisioned it, included a constellation of associated expectations and responsibilities. And we can only touch briefly on four of these this afternoon. And as they come up on the slides now, they're going to come up in some kind of block order here. You'll have to just kind of follow along. The slides are embedded in Media Shout, so whole slides show up as instead of the point-by-point thing. So just kind of hang in there with us as we work through this. It'll all be there at one time or another. Most basic, though, as you'll notice up on the screen, was the sharing of material resources. In the ancient world, a person's brothers and sisters provided the first line of defense against the ever-present threat of economic hardship, which was a big, big deal back in a world where the great majority of people were living on the margins. This is what we saw in the story of Marcus and the North African church, and it explains the community of goods in the early chapters of the book of Acts as well. To fail to share one's resources in times of need was to betray a brother after the analogy of Cain. Here are some excerpts from 1 John. "By this it is evident that evident who are the children of God and who are the children of the devil. Whoever does not love his brother, we should not be like Cain, who was of the evil one and murdered his brother. We know that we have passed out of death into life because we love the brothers. Everyone who hates his brother is a murderer. We ought to lay down our lives for the brothers. But if anyone has the world's good and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him?" A second expectation related to sibling solidarity in the early church was that of non-retaliation, of refusing to play the honor game within the family. One writer describes the world of the New Testament as a fiercely competitive environment in which virtually any social interchange, such as business affairs, politics, sport, literary contests, dinner invitations, or even arranging a marriage, I would say especially arranging a marriage, constitutes an arena in which people strive to enhance their honor at someone else's expense. In particular, males in the Mediterranean world felt compelled to get even for every interpersonal affront or injustice in order to defend their public honor. The only exception, the only social context in which the honor game was off limits was the blood family, particularly, again, sibling relationships. Plutarch has left us our only surviving treatise on the topic of brotherhood from the ancient world. And he identifies the honor game as singularly inappropriate among siblings. Now, Plutarch is a realist who recognizes that one brother will often be more naturally gifted than a sibling for engaging in honorable public endeavors. In such cases, Plutarch insists, the superior brother should defer to the inferior. The truly virtuous, stronger sibling, quote, permits his brother to be left out of no task that is worthy of notice and would bring honor, but makes his brother a sharer in all honorable enterprises. And he elaborates, one would therefore advise a brother in the first place to make his brother's partners in those respects in which he is considered to be superior, adorning them with a portion of his repute and adopting them into his friendships. And if he is a cleverer speaker than they, to make his eloquence available for their use as though it were no less theirs than his. In the next place, to make manifest to them neither haughtiness nor disdain, but rather by deferring to them and conforming his character to theirs, to make his superiority secure from envy, and to equalize, so far as this is attainable, the disparity of his fortune by his moderation of spirit. Later in the treatise, Plutarch decries, quote, a contentious and ambitious spirit among siblings. Ideally, brothers should envy no one, but if this is impossible, they should turn their malignancy outward and drain it off on those not of their blood, by nature suitable objects for envy and jealousy. Now, if the honor game was off limits within the family in the ancient world, imagine how utterly shameful it would have been for a brother to seek compensation or revenge for some real or perceived fraternal offense outside the family through litigation in the public courts, perhaps. Well, this, of course, brings us to 1 Corinthians 6, where Paul warns the family of God at Corinth about this very practice, using brother four times in just four verses. Paul writes, can it be that there is not one wise person among you who will be able to arbitrate between his brothers? Instead, brother goes to law against brother, and that before unbelievers? Why not rather put up with injustice? Why not rather be cheated? Instead, you act unjustly and cheat, and this to brothers. The HCSB Holman Christian translation I've cited here is stylistically a bit awkward with its brother, 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 brother language, but it is much better than the gender-neutral NRSV, which translates each of the four occurrences of adelphos as, quote, believer, and thereby deprives the text of much of its rhetorical power. This is important because, as I mentioned, brother is not merely a cipher for believer here or anywhere else in the New Testament. In fact, the density of Paul's sibling language here in 1 Corinthians 5 is no or 6 is no accident. There are portions of Paul's letters in which family language, family words like brother, occur much more frequently than they do elsewhere in the same letter. If we were to chart the occurrences of adelphos throughout the New Testament, we would see spikes here and there where brother appears several times in just a few short verses and then disappears for a paragraph or two or even a whole chapter. And those of you who are pinheads like me and have Bible programs that can do diagrams of these kind of things, I'd encourage you to do just that. Chart the frequency of the occurrence of adelphos in your New Testament, and have your Bible program generate a little diagram. It'll be very illuminating. And there's a reason for that. Anthropologists note that kinship terms are employed rather sparingly in most societies. When they do occur, family words are utilized for some very specific reasons. One anthropologist, Roger Kiesing, notes the following. A common pattern seems to be to refer to a person's kinship relation to you, not in everyday conversation, but in situations when that person is violating the norms of kinship, or in situations when you're trying to manipulate him. Lend me a dollar, brother. When my daughters were little, we'd be, you know, sitting on our big king bed in our bedroom playing cards or doing something, and I would say to Rachel, I'd say, Rachel, do you love your daddy? And she'd roll her eyes because she knew it was a setup. I was going to tell her to go to the refrigerator and get me a soda, you know? And she would do the same thing. Do you love your daughter? And, you know, we use these terms to do social engineering. And so it is here in 1 Corinthians. What Paul is doing here, where brother occurs four times in a few verses, is some very intentional social engineering. He is challenging the Christians to live like the siblings that they indeed are in the eyes of their Heavenly Father, according to the norms and expectations of sibling relationships in the world in which the early Christians lived. A third aspect of the sibling bond enjoyed by brothers and sisters in the ancient world was a strong sense of emotional attachment, what we might call affective solidarity. In the New Testament, we see this most clearly in the connections that Paul experienced with his brothers and sisters in the family of God. Paul claims, for example, to have the Philippians in his heart. He longs for them all with, quote, the affection of Christ Jesus, early in Philippians. Later in the letter, he exhorts, therefore, my beloved brethren, whom I long to see, my joy and my crown, so stand firm in the Lord, my beloved. Finally, the fourth characteristic of sibling relations I'd like us to come to grips with it today is that of family loyalty, specifically the inevitable conflict that the early Christians faced between loyalty to their natural families and loyalty to the family of God. And here's where it gets a little scandalous and kind of fun. To return for a moment to third century North Africa, it is interesting to note that when our former actor friend Marcus finds himself backed up against the wall economically, his natural family, which would of course be expected to provide for his material needs, is nowhere on the horizon. The most likely explanation is that Marcus's family had disowned him when he converted to Christianity. This conflict of loyalties is hardly unique to third century North African Christianity. It finds its genesis, in fact, all the way back in the teachings and activities of Jesus in the Gospels. We find three categories of family sayings in the teachings of Jesus. First, we have what we'll call the pro-family passages there at the top of the triangle. Texts that explicitly encourage natural family loyalty and solidarity. Jesus reiterates the commandment from the Decalogue, honor your father and mother. He reminds his audience of God's design for marriage from Genesis 2, adding what God has joined together, let no one separate. Passages like this underscore the importance of the natural family in the teachings of Jesus. But then there are also, category two, a number of anti-family sayings. Like Luke 14:23, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Or Matthew 8, where a potential disciple says to Jesus, let me first go and bury my father. And Jesus replies, let the dead bury their own dead. You follow me. So we have pro-family sayings, anti-family sayings, and then the third point of the triangle up there, we have a category of teaching that relates not to our natural families at all, but rather to the faith family, the new faith family of followers that Jesus is gathering around himself. In Mark 10, Jesus says to Peter, there's no one who has left house or brothers or sisters or mother or father or children or lands for my sake and for the gospel who will not receive 100-fold now in this time houses and brothers and sisters and mothers and children and lands. In Mark 3, perhaps most familiar, Jesus asks, who are my mother and my brothers? And then he says, here are my mother and my brothers, for whoever does the will of God, he is my brother, my sister, and my mother. Just as an aside, at our church we were going through the Gospel of Mark 1 year, and I was scheduled to preach on Mother's Day. And We were going to do a topical sermon on Mother's Day, and I told the guys, you know, I'm kind of burnt out on topical sermons. Can I just stay in Mark and keep going? They go, sure, because I'm in a preaching rotation. I preach about once a month. And I looked at our schedule, and lo and behold, this was the next passage on the schedule. So I preached a sermon entitled Jesus and His Mommy on Mother's Day. It went over okay. All right. Pro-family sayings, anti-family sayings, faith-family sayings, the passages I've cited, of course, are only representative, but even these texts reveal the challenges we face in trying to make sense of what Jesus said about family. Now, this is not the place to look at these passages in detail. We will grapple with the gospel evidence in more general terms here today as we try to harmonize these three kinds of family teachings in some kind of coherent set of values and priorities. First, what I want to do is just remind us how few pro-family passages we find in the Gospels. Several years ago, I was invited to contribute a chapter to a Christian education textbook on family ministry. The author's expertise was in education, not biblical studies, but he wanted to build his practical theology of family on a biblical theology of family, and he asked if I would write a chapter on Jesus and family in the Gospels. I politely declined the invitation, telling him I didn't think there was enough material to write a theology of natural family relations from the Gospels. Honor your father and mother. Stay married. Well, there may be more, but there's not much more. In contrast, there are, in fact, many more faith family and anti-family passages in the Gospels than there are pro-family passages. And this is also true of Paul's letters, where church family language abounds. Brother, father, inheritance, adoption, children of God. And texts about natural family relations, as informative as they are rather few and far between. The three categories of family sayings in the Gospels raise two significant issues that can help us harmonize them together, and they're up there on the screen. The first one is obvious, and that is the theological dissonance that obtains between the pro-family passages on the one hand and the anti-family passages on the other. Maybe we can back up the slides there a notch. Yeah, there we go. And you can see the theological dissonance there. Consider the matter of our attitude toward our parents. In one place, Jesus says, honor your father and mother. Elsewhere, in the same gospel, he tells a man who wants to bury his father, leave the dead to bury their own dead. Now, neither Jesus or Matthew seem to have a problem with these two apparently contradictory sayings coming from the mouth of the same individual. And then there's Luke 14:23, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother, etc., etc. Dissonance indeed. The second issue there up on the screen raised by the gospel evidence is not self-evident to modern Western readers, but it would have been immediately apparent and highly troubling to Jesus' early followers. What I have in mind here is the loyalty conflict that is forcefully raised by the very idea of belonging to two families, a natural family and a faith family. And here we can go ahead and forward the slide. Here then, some cultural background proves helpful. Ancient Mediterranean society was a strong group culture where one, the health and survival of the group took priority over the goals and desires of individual members, and number two, where the most important group was the family. This meant that loyalty to family constituted the paramount relational virtue for persons in the New Testament world. To help us appreciate the way strong group priorities inform family loyalty, I have substituted the word family, where the author used the word group in a description of strong group values from the pen of Bruce Molina up here on the screen. Quote, the person perceives himself or herself to be a member of a family and responsible to the family for his or her actions, destiny, career, development, and life in general. The individual person is embedded in the family and is free to do what he or she feels right and necessary only if in accord with family norms, and only if the action is in the family's best interest. The family has priority over the individual member. Now, this sounds rather strange to us, but if you think about it, this subordination of individual desires to the interest of the family as a whole is obviously reflected in something that most of us are familiar about from the ancient world, namely the practice of arranged marriages. In the ancient world, parents chose mates for their children because only the parents who were networked in the broader village community could determine whether a particular match
between two individuals was in the interest of the family unit. And this is the key point. In the New Testament world, it was all about the interests of the family as a whole. So, in a social environment where family loyalty was paramount, where personal goals and desires were subordinated to the honor, the health, and the future viability of the family, it's easy to see how Jesus' challenge to join a new family would have generated an unavoidable and a profound loyalty conflict. Now I have two families competing for my allegiance, my natural family and my church family. To which family do I now owe this strong group allegiance, this undying loyalty? My natural family or my faith family? Well, the answer to that question, biblically and historically, is that the family of God is to take priority over my natural family. But this is certainly not how American evangelicals have typically framed it. Evangelical relational priorities, we do an end run around the vexing issue of family loyalty by separating loyalty to God from loyalty to God's family, and then placing loyalty to natural family in between the two. This, however, will not work, not in the least, because I cannot be a follower of Jesus without being a loyal member of his group. This is a crucial consideration. During his earthly ministry, Jesus did not call individuals into a private relationship with him. Personal, yes. Private, no. He challenged his followers to join a movement. He called them to be part of a new family. And it was within this new family, and only within this family, that Jesus' followers related to him one-on-one. As Paul would put it several decades later, using a different metaphor, we were all baptized into one body. In one context, I described it as being justified and familified when we are converted. The notion that loyalty to God could somehow be separated from loyalty to God's family was not even on the radar screen of Jesus and the early Christians. Cyprian of Carthage would later put it like this: "He who does not have the church for his mother cannot have God for his father." Perhaps an analogy will help. I jog on the beach for exercise. In fact, it may grieve some of you from the Midwest to know that I was jogging in 60-degree weather a couple days ago along the beach. So that was for free, okay. My hometown is quite affluent, so I often run past people who can afford to pay others to guide them through their daily workouts. The sociology of these training sessions varies. Some folks hire a personal trainer who disciples them one-on-one in their exercise program. Others, presumably with less discretionary income, belong to groups of people led by a trainer of some sort. A Pilates class I often see while jogging is an example of this latter arrangement. The point here is that the dynamics of the Christian life are more like that experienced by a student in a Pilates class than a fellow with his personal trainer. The Pilates student relates to her instructor as part of a group. We relate to Jesus as part of his family. Now, every analogy ultimately breaks down, this one at many levels, but I trust you get the point. Western evangelicals tend to think of Jesus as a personal spiritual trainer with whom we interact alone, apart from relationships with our brothers and sisters in Christ. This allows us conveniently to distinguish between loyalty to God and loyalty to God's family. This is decidedly not how the early Christians conceived of their relationship with God and his church. I would suggest then that Jesus' relational priorities look something like this. At this point, I find it helpful to ask which set of relational priorities best addresses the two key issues, the theological dissonance and the potential conflict of family loyalties that were raised by our three kinds of family teachings in the Gospels. Evangelical relational priorities privilege the natural family over the faith family. And I think if you click, we'll get that highlighted there. There we are. And this solves the vexing problem of family loyalty, but it does so in favor of the natural family. Go ahead and forward the slide again. And so much for that, so far so good. But how about the issue of theological dissonance? And you can click again now. If anything, our evangelical relational priorities exacerbate the problem, for the more we prioritize natural family relations in the teaching of Jesus, the less sense we can make of the anti-family passages. And I think we've all struggled with this as we've prepared messages and this and that and run into some of these texts in the Gospels. Why would a pro-family Jesus, if indeed he is at the gate pro-family, say so many harsh things about the natural family? I find the dissonance generated by this approach to be intolerable, and frankly, the exegetical gymnastics necessary to interpret the anti-family passages under this paradigm strike me ultimately as quite unconvincing. Go ahead and change the next slide. Well, then how then do Jesus' relational priorities fare? Go ahead and advance. Here, God and his family take priority over our natural families. And the problem of conflicting family loyalty is solved once again, this time in favor of the natural family. Now, in favor of the church family. Now, this is a hard set of priorities for Western evangelicals to embrace, but notice that the theological dissonance raised by the anti-family passages now finds adequate explanation. Jesus lived, and you can go ahead and forward one more there. Yes, thank you. Jesus lived in a strong group culture where family loyalty reigned supreme. So if, as Jesus' relational priorities assume, Jesus intended to establish a new faith family, one which would in some sense, still to be defined, take priority over the natural family, he would obviously have to challenge natural family loyalty again and again during his earthly ministry. And this is precisely what we find in the Gospels. Now, this rather scandalous suggestion that my church family ought to take priority over my natural family cries out for the kind of careful nuancing that's certainly beyond the scope of a 60-minute presentation, and I'm glad we have a breakout group later. Hopefully we can interact a bit there. But I do want to offer a pair of qualifications and then some concluding challenges. First of all, qualification number one, the church is a family, not a business. It's an organism, not an organization. As most of us in this room are quite well aware, the word translated church in our Bible simply means a gathering or assembly of people. For the early Christians, church was not a place, and it was certainly not an institution with a building, a budget, and a myriad of efficiently run programs. This means that qualification number two, the commitment to which Jesus calls us, is a relational commitment, not an institutional commitment. We will need to learn to think of church in deeply relational terms before we will ever be willing to make the kind of commitment to Jesus' family that characterized the early Christians. To become a follower of Jesus is to become loyalty to the people of God, not to some CEO pastor's yearly vision or to the demands of a church's calendar of programs. Indeed, all four of our characteristics of the church as a family are deeply relational in nature. Go ahead and forward the slide. And I would like to suggest by way of application that in our increasingly post-Christian culture, this deeply relational view of church as a surrogate family will be absolutely indispensable to passing on the Christian faith to the next generation of young people in our churches. Social scientists emphasize the role of community in establishing and reinforcing the religious convictions of its members, the social construction of knowledge, if you will. Now, most of us in this room, I hope, will forcefully reject the idea championed by our extreme postmodern theorists that our communities construct truth ex nihilo. But folks, we'd better get on board with the reality that communities powerfully socialize their members to buy in to the beliefs and worldviews of those communities. Indeed, this is all quite biblical. Paul himself warned the Corinthians, "Do not be deceived, bad company corrupts good morals." I never cease to be amazed by parents, and many of us have run into them, who tell me they are unwilling to impose their spiritual convictions on their children because they want them to make their own decisions about religion. So they send their kids off to school, first the public schools, then the best university they can afford, so that their children can learn to think, quote unquote, for themselves. No one thinks for himself. Immaculate perception is an illustrious illusion, okay? Every high school campus, every university, public or private, is a community with a dominant, defining, circumscribed view of reality, and that includes religious reality. Peer relations on a high school campus, power relations between esteemed professors and lowly students at the university, all these virtually guarantee that our children will be socialized to assimilate the belief structures and moral priorities of these communities, unless, that is, they are simultaneously enmeshed and confronted with the influence of another more compelling community. And here's where the church as a family comes in. Some communities, folks, are simply more powerful and ultimately more effective than others in socializing their members to adopt their worldview. This is a crucial observation in an era when more and more of our young people are leaving the faith. There was a time when a well-executed youth program offered a community socialization experience that could compete with anything the world or the high school campus had to offer. Back in the 1970s and 1980s, when I was in youth ministry, Life Stage Ministries targeting high schoolers and college students played a central role in establishing and reinforcing deep Christian convictions among our young people during their formative years. This is no longer the case. Not only has the surrounding culture become less and less Christian, the nearly irresistible socializing influence of pagan culture and community now confronts our teenagers and young adults 24/7 in social media, even while they're sitting in church. It's Wednesday night in the youth room. Josh, the high school pastor, challenges his teenagers to remain sexually pure for Jesus. Sam, in the back row, scrolls through images of a scantily clad pop star twerking on his smartphone. Sam will probably not even attend church at all a few years from now. Research by the Barna Group finds 59% of millennials leaving church permanently or for an extended period during the first decade of their adult life. Barna cites a number of reasons for the exodus. More interesting in the present connection are the reasons the other 41% choose to stay. Apparently, God's people, and here's the good news, still have the resources to provide a community experience whose power to socialize its members rivals anything the world can throw at us. As it turns out, according to Barna, quote, the most positive church experiences among millennials are relational, but not just any relationship will do. Intergenerational relationships top the list of reasons that young people remain connected to their faith communities, and many of you have been exposed to this research. Those who stayed in Barna's study were twice as likely to have a close personal friendship with an adult in the church as those who left. David Kinneman puts it all together in a summary of the group's findings. Cultivating intergenerational relationships, Kinneman writes, is one of the most important ways in which effective faith communities are developing flourishing faith in both young and old. In many churches, this means changing the metaphor from simply passing the baton to the next generation to a more functional biblical picture of a body, I might have said a family, that is the entire community of faith across the entire lifespan working together to fulfill God's purposes. This brings us to a final point of application, one that concerns unmarried adults of whatever sexual orientation. Most of the millennials Barna surveyed were single, and according to the 2010 census, 44% of the U.S. population were unmarried, and that's increased certainly since. Yet our theology of family is so biblically out of balance that it's left us with virtually nothing of substance in the way of a theology of singleness and celibacy. Much of this is understandable. Marriage and family have been under siege in America ever since the sexual revolution in the 1960s, and the church has responded by placing its focus squarely on the family in recent decades. The result of all this, however, for the increasing numbers of singles in society and in our churches has not been positive. I served as a pastor of single adults for 5 years and interacted with enough unmarried adults over the years to appreciate how they view church and, more importantly, how singles feel the church views them. By giving disproportionate attention to marriage, parenting, and family dynamics, natural family dynamics, that is, in our sermons and church programming, we essentially communicate to our unmarried brothers and sisters that they will only finally grow up and become real adult Christians when they get married and have a family. Sermons and books that extol the marriage relationship as the primary place where spiritual growth occurs only reinforce this message. And we can trace the theological roots of this unbiblical view of singleness and marriage right back to our evangelical relational priorities, which privilege the natural family over God's family and thereby encourage an overly family-centered ministry. Notice that the biblical alternative that we encounter in Jesus's relational priorities encourages us to focus instead on the church family, which includes, of course, persons of every marital status. When we allow God's family to occupy first place in our hierarchy of relational loyalties, marriage ceases to be the crucible for spiritual formation and becomes one of any number of church family relationships that provide a context for growth in Christ. Now, even a single person, well, maybe The Apostle Paul, for example, can grow in his faith. The New Testament commends the family of God, not marriage, as the primary community in which spiritual growth occurs. Now, am I implying that God does not use our relationships with our spouses to grow us up in Christ? Of course not. I am simply suggesting that God can and does work the same miracles of transformation in relationships with other members in our church family. To come at this another way, consider the Great Commission. You're all familiar with it. All authority, Jesus says, in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and get married and make babies in every nation, teaching them to be responsible, productive citizens who grow up, get married, and make babies of their own. And surely I am with you always, even when you become grandparents. Well, that, of course, is not the Great Commission, but you might not know it by our church programming, much of which seems to be based on the charge to be fruitful and multiply in Genesis chapter 1, a command that is nowhere reiterated in the New Testament. The Great Commission, of course, is about a different kind of procreation entirely. Go and make disciples of all nations. Among the early Christians, marriage and singleness were both subordinated to the overarching model of the church as a family and to an overarching passion to obey the Great Commission and win the world for Christ. Mission, marriage, and singleness intersect most clearly, of course, in 1 Corinthians 7, where marriage is viewed as, quote, a concession to our physical desires, verse 6, and singleness is commended as the superior way to, quote, be devoted to the Lord in both body and spirit, verse 34. As the first verse, in the very first verse of the passage, Paul writes, it is good for a man not to marry. Well, he may be quoting the Corinthians, but what he proceeds to talk about is very, 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 very interesting. Later on, he writes, an unmarried man is concerned about the Lord's affairs, how he can please the Lord, but a married man is concerned about the affairs of this world, how he can please his wife, and his interests are divided. An unmarried woman or virgin is concerned about the Lord's affairs. Her aim is to be devoted to the Lord in both body and spirit. But a married woman is concerned about the affairs of this world, how she can please her husband. I am saying this for your own good, not to restrict you, but that you may live in a right way, in undivided devotion to the Lord. Now, this is not all Paul says about marriage, of course, but it is pretty much all he says about singleness, and it's the only place in the Bible where singleness and marriage are evaluated side by side for their respective abilities to facilitate, quote, the Lord's affairs. Now, we may give lip service to 1 Corinthians, but the way we do church proves to be the litmus test for our theology of marriage and singleness. I'm about to read you an excerpt from a story that ran on the front page of the print edition of the New York Times back during the recession back in 2011. It reads like this: like all too many Americans, Mark Almiel, age 37, was laid off in the spring of 2009 when his workplace downsized. He's been searching for an appropriate position ever since, replying to more than 500 job postings without success. But Mr. Almiel, despite a sterling education and years of experience, has faced an obstacle that does not exist in most professions. He is a single pastor in a field where those doing the hiring overwhelmingly prefer married people, and especially married men with children. Apparently somebody has not read 1 Corinthians 7. Well, it remains that most adults will in fact ultimately marry, but many will not, and those who do are marrying much later in life, often leaving a decade or so of single adulthood between adolescence and matrimony. And then there are those brothers and sisters among us who struggle with same-sex attraction. A Christian community that privileges the natural family over the family of God and extols marriage as the epitome of human relationships has nothing to offer to those among us who must commit to celibacy for a season or even for a lifetime in order to live in a manner pleasing to the Lord. The spiritual lives of our unmarried brothers and sisters of whatever sexual orientation depend upon a biblical ecclesiology, which one, situates both singleness and marriage under the overarching rubric of the family of God, and which two, encourages singles and families in the church to cultivate meaningful intergenerational relationships with one another, and which three, mobilizes everyone in the community to use their gifts to further the cause of the gospel in a way that fits their current life situation. The time has passed for church as a utilitarian consumer commodity that exists to service the spiritual needs of the natural family. The time has passed for big auditorium consumer Christianity. The time has passed for celebrity pastors, relationally isolated from the people they teach, delivering their wares by means of video feeds from remote sites. The time has passed for the church as a business, and I think my time is way past to talk about the church as a family. So I hope I'll see some of you in the breakout session. Thank you for being patient.
Thank you very much, Joe. It was very thought-provoking. You can understand why I wanted him to be here. When you think about this, when you think about local churches that refer to themselves as family-friendly, which family? I came away from the lecture really pondering that. And I think predominantly what it refers to is parents with children, with little to no thought given to singles, be it never married or divorced, or those who are called to singleness or who struggle with same-sex attraction, even as Joe shared. In many respects, friends, what he is saying is, you know the expression, blood is thicker than water. Turn that around. That's what Joe's doing, based upon the scriptures, as he would expound them for us. Water is thicker than blood.
I like that. Can I use that?
Now, you know, when I said that, you think 101 different things. I'm thinking, okay, now he's talking about baptism like Michael Lawrence did, so he's pushing that agenda. It's a euphemism. It's a figure of speech for being a Christian in the church. Yes, please, Joe, use it. It's not original with me. As I typically say, if anything's original with me, doubt it, because it's probably heretical or heterodox at best. Well, there are a number of questions I'm sure this has raised for you, and please come to the session that Joe will be leading or being a part of to ask those questions. And our next lecture will also be in that session, addressing the missional church or the missional community as the church.